What you're about to listen to is Alistair Duncan's talk at St. Bartholomew's Hospital on June 27th, 2012. It was entitled A Study in Barts, and it's about Sherlock Holmes and John Watson's relationship through Barts Hospital. At the very beginning, the air conditioner was running, so try and ignore the background noise. It ends about halfway through, so that'll be great. And there's a Q&A afterwards, which is fantastic and sort of expands on his talk and some other interesting tidbits, including what Sherlock Holmes and John Watson were originally called, and sort of more of the origins of John Watson. As always, we would like to thank our sponsors, the Baker Street Journal and Wessex Press, two fantastic organizations and publications. You should definitely check them out at www.bakerstreetjournal.com. and at www.wessexpress.com. They have all the Sherlock Holmes things you could ever want. As always, thank you so much for your support, and enjoy!
And a really interesting book called Close to Homes, so if you want to have a look for that, give it a read. And he's just going to talk to us about Watson and Holmes and how they met at Barts, and a lot more besides, and just keep us enthralled basically for the next hour. So I hope you all enjoy yourself, and thank you very much.
As you can see, I'm entitled to this, I'll get the other side. Sherlock Holmes, John Watson, England's Great Hospital. I think it took me more time to come up with that title than the rest of the slideshow, but we'll see how we get on. So to kick off, a slide that requires no commentary. The picture is supposedly of me under that hat as a Victorian moment. There was a cover of one of my books there, but I thought, in the spirit of the overt self-promotion, I put myself in one. So if anyone wants to look at my rants on Twitter, you can make a note of the name at the bottom there now. Be warned in advance, it's mostly about how annoyed I am with the train I'm on, rather than what to do with Sherlock Holmes or who's bumping into me at night, so be prepared for lots of mindless rant. These are the topics I intend to whiz my way through, depending on how nervous I get. So we'll start with the origin of Holmes and Watson, their first meeting. This hospital in the 2 years' stay for reasons that I'll come to. Screen adaptations and why this great hospital bear the features in them. A brief bit on the modern Sherlock series and this hospital. I stress in advance I'm not an authority on that, so if you've got any burning questions on the trivia to the BBC Sherlock, I won't be the person to help you. But there are two people in the audience I will drag up here. Especially if they put any faces at me during. Then there'll be a brief bit on the Sherlock Society of London, which will be my shameless attempt to try and get you all to join. Then, as I state, quite up front, some gratuitous advertising, and then I'll take questions. Please make them. So Arthur Conan Doyle wrote his first Holmes novel during 1886. And unfortunately, had a tremendous amount of trouble getting anyone to pick it up. No one was interested. I think about 3 or 4 months, I'm not quite sure, before Hutchinson and Wardlock and Co. bought it for publication in Beaton's Christmas Annual, but they suppressed it for an entire year. I'm going to get the quote a bit wrong here, but I'll get the basic gist of it, because they told Conan Doyle that the market was presently flooded with cheap fiction. But in 1886, it was not a good time to publish it, so they held it down for a year. And they paid him the princely sum once off, £25 for it. A reasonable sum, but they took the copyright and everything, and he got no further money from it at all. Now, anyone with a basic knowledge of Conan Doyle probably have heard of Dr. Joseph Bell, whose diagnostic technique was what he took and based Sherlock Holmes' deductive technique on, the idea of spotting the trifles and building up a whole case. In addition, there was a documentary which picking Adrian Conemaugh, which I think was filmed in the 60s, when Adrian Conemaugh said that Joseph Bell was the inspiration for Schopenhauer's deductive technique, which he claimed, as a matter of opinion, that he claimed that Schopenhauer's personality in every other respect was based on his father. The origins of Watson are not quite so clear, but depending on the documentary you watch, you'll hear a different opinion. One I most recently saw mentioned, I think, a fellow professor at Edinburgh called Patrick Heron of Watson, who is based on by the lead and who serves, but Conan Doyle knew a doctor by the name of John Watson in Portsmouth. So there's no cut and dried answer to where the origins of Watson came. Now, in the study in Scarlet, which is the first story, Watson bumps into a friend called Stanford. Seen the modern BBC series, you'll remember that character. But in the original story, they meet in the Criterion Bar, which still exists. It's on-site the Criterion Restaurant. What is the Criterion Restaurant? Sorry, it's on-site the Criterion Theatre in Piccadilly, so you can be there and see it. They meet there, they take a carriage ride to this building, Holden Restaurant, which no longer exists, during which they discuss this mysterious man, Sherlock Holmes, who is looking for a flatmate like Watson. And then Stanford, the carriage, brings Watson here to Bart's and the two men meet. So if you came down to the museum, you probably would have seen the plan. This drawing, I think, is taken from one of the first book published versions of the study in Scarlet. Not by the famous illustrator Sidney Paget, but by a man called, I think, George Hutchinson. And it features Holmes on the left there. I always wonder which one of Watson's right, but I presume it's the one before. Maybe wrong. But they meet while Holmes is conducting a test for detecting the blood. Now, a study in Scarlet was published in 1887, but it was reportedly set in 1881. And from the perspective of the past, those are two quite interesting years. Principally, Ethel Gordon Manton, which you can see there, became the first matron of the hospital at the age of 24 in 1881. You have to remember that this was an era when most professions, but probably medicine above all, were quite closed shops for women. So she was kind of pioneering her name up there in nursing as far as 1911. So in 1881, the very final story is set, she would be walking the corridors of Bath, you know, as a woman. In 1887, the year which was published, she was forced to leave the hospital after she got married on the grounds of being married made unsuitable for her to work as a matron. Not quite sure of the logic of that. But she subsequently went on to found the British Journal of Nursing and was the first president of the International Council of Nurses, which she held for 5 years. And at the very year she left the hospital, Barts admitted its first student. So those 2 years were very important to Bath. Manson was also responsible for laying down the principle of different styles and colours of nursing uniforms to denote grades or ranks of nurses. So she's responsible for quite a lot of the nursing paraphernalia we see today. She also briefly lived for a period of time at number 20 Upper Wimpole Street. And if you know anything about Conan Doyle, you'll know that number 2 Upper Wimpole Street in 1891, Conan Doyle ran his brief and argued the unsuccessful ophthalmic practice. So she was really not too far away. Here's a good question for you. Messy and bizarre, but I'm going to call that sentence in a minute. Have a think on that. What was Bart's having on West Moriarty? I would open that up to suggestions, but you might be here a while. Here's the answer. They're both seen as quite indelible parts of the Sherlock Holmes universe, but they both only really have one active appearance. Bearing in mind there are 60 stories in total, it's quite an achievement to have become part of the fabric with so minimal screen time as well as brief. And it is the screen that's largely responsible. So the first reason that Bart is really big is because it only appears in one story, if I may, certainly in Scarlet. At the bottom here you see a portrayal of that meeting in the 1950s Sherlock Holmes series Scarlet on Howard, who was the son of Leslie Howard. As you see here, they did a laboratory meeting between Holmes and Watson, but if memory serves, I haven't watched it for a while, they didn't actually state that it was Bart's hospital. It was just a laboratory somewhere. And aside from this meeting, the rest of this particular episode had nothing to do with studying stars. It's sort of in the original story. These Britain series in 1960s did film studying stars, but they already had Holmes and Watson acquainted. Jerry Brett's famous Granada series of the 1980s and 90s didn't worry about it at all. So it's only in the BBC series now that Bart is getting into the real showing. So Conan Doyle wrote 60 stories in total, only four of which are novels. And of the four novels, the first and last, say here, are hardly adapted, and that's because they both feature very lengthy flashbacks in which Holmes, Watson, most of the principal characters we're used to do not feature at all. So I personally strongly suspect TV executives shy away from dramatising when the principal characters, let's face it, the principal draw for most viewers are going to be absent for 50% or so of the story. Studying Scarlet in the book has a lengthy flashback to the Mormons in Middle America and the Valley of Fear flashback to, I think it's the Scowler.
Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania. So you've got a very lengthy backstory, which is as strong as that most people struggle to get through. Just be wishing to show up over the screen. So now the bit where I know the least about. So I tip my hat to two ladies who are not here today, who are behind a website called Sherlockology, which some of you may be familiar with. I'm not seeing anybody. Here's a little bit of trivia here. So, like so many things that actually have not its name attached to them, they're filmed in Wales. So the Bart laboratory scenes that we see were filmed in the School of Earth and Ocean Sciences at Cardiff University, and more scenes in an actual working unit, more also in Cardiff. Now, during the DVD commentary of The Great Game, which is the third episode of Series 1 of Sherlock, Benjamin Cumberbatch remarks that they filmed those three stories in reverse order. So in The Great Game, the last episode of that series, first time he'd seen the laboratory, and in the first episode he'd seen it many times. So he had to control himself and not look like he'd seen it before, knowing that the episode was going to go out in the opposite order in which they were filming. And you can probably look and see that between The Great Game, which was filmed first when the war had not been used, and the filming of A Study in Pink, it had actually been legitimately used as a war. So it's become a working more during the building process, and he had to sort of try and make sure that he didn't get too much like his own character in spot the cheeky spot. So three characters in modern television series who have a direct connection to Bart: Mike Stafford, who brings John Watson to Bart's dimension. The monster Criterion Bart takes the form of the Criterion Art Cafe. You see the two of them drinking. If you've seen the episode, they have a moment on a bench where they discuss John Serves in Afghanistan and drinking out the Criterion label cup. Jim, aka Moriarty from IT, who we all know from episode 3. I would do the talking voice, but I think I messed it up. I do quite think it was a good one. You might argue on YouTube. So if you go to one of the many websites the BBC has created, if you miss a particular instance, more than this blog, you'll find all these little extracts about Jim's manager going mental, as they say there. And ultimately, in the final episode, he abandons that alter ego and his connection to the hospital. Finally, and most significantly, in my argument, Molly Hooper, who lays claim to being the only non-canonical character and has become a hugely integral part of the show. I'm highly tempted to bring people in here who had an interview with her at this point, but I won't be that cruel. I know how bad it is up here, so I won't subject anyone else to it. I'm just losing myself in my own mindset. Wonderful profession.
Serves you right.
Sorry, one minor note on this page. Molly Hooper actually never gets a job title or any kind of real idea what she does, and this is entirely deliberate in order that the writers can turn their hand to anything in the stories. Gives them complete freedom, complete freedom of movement with that. So we might see her getting up to all sorts in future episodes. Again, someone else may know more about that.
She's in series 3.
Maybe she
She's coming back.
Right, so the only scenes that have actually been filmed here are the outside shots. The ones they occasionally use to connect scenes in the story, and obviously when Mr. Cumberbatch to jump off the roof in the most recent episode. And we see numerous other mentions without actual visuals of parts, and usually in respect of body parts. So, the bloody head in the fridge. Eyeball was in the microwave. And I've lost it. The bag of thumbs in the fridge, freezer drawer. In the first episode of series 2. Since you worked away with us, I can't find out where I am at the moment. So, a society. This is where I find out. I've got my facts from earlier on, so I hope I raised eyebrows there. Society was founded in 1934.
Mm-hmm.
It was suspended at the outbreak of the Second World War, and then refounded in 1951, during or just after the Festival of Britain. As part of the festival, a mock-up of 221B sitting room set up in the Abbey National Bank on Baker Street proved an enormous draw. Political evidently demonstrated such an interest in Holmes that it was felt a good idea to resurrect the society, which was done. And it's been running uninterrupted ever since. Under its new name, Sherlock Holmes Society, at Holmes, it was just the Sherlock Holmes Society before that. There's been logs in the front row, very reassuring. A good number of the exhibits from that exhibition have found their way into the Sherlock Holmes pub. Probably not all of them, I suspect, but certainly most. They adorn the walls of the ground floor and a small version of the mocked-up 221B sitting room on the first floor of the pub adjacent to the restaurant dining area. How many of you have been, I don't know, but if you haven't been, it's definitely not. And they're quite often playing episodes of the Granada series on the televisions in there as well, although bizarrely they don't have the sound of it. I've never actually understood that.
It's because we have the dialogue memorized.
So we get together for several main events a year. I think I've got these months broadly right. January for the annual dinner. March for generally a lecture. May for annual general meeting and associated events. October, I think, for the Mark Spring Green lecture. November for film meetings. I don't think there are any particular events I remember in December. The journal is published twice a year. Reports and articles by members covering all sorts of subjects, doing books, something to do with the UCC series. That's probably a really awful attempt at trying to get you to join, but that's the space. And now the bit I labelled in my introduction as gratuitous advertising.
Aww.
So I'm not here to show up and gave me my few trivia facts on the UCC series, and there's their website, if you don't already know. The Baker Street Babes, two of which are here, are responsible for a very entertaining and frequently foul-mouthed series of on any and all subjects relating to both the modern series and the original canon. No subject is off limits from what I've heard. I mean literally heard, I mean reading one. And finally, the website for the Sherlock Holmes Society of London itself. You know, if you are interested in joining or simply want to find out more than I have gabbled out in these few minutes. can go and visit and you can sign up there. And you can start joining us at our break events. And now the part-time drinking. Anyone's got a question? I'll do my best to either look terrified or answer it. Either I was so good or I was so bad. There's not a single thing.
Just a question on your topic, sort of with new recent organizations, which Jones got a view with
I get the impression from the ripple of laughter that my facial expression just came up. I enjoyed them. You know, I went to the cinema, I saw them both. I own both on DVD. I don't think I'd be too far adrift if I said they were, in some respects, rather wide at the mark, but that's a matter of opinion. A lot of people are really passionate about them and think they correct a lot of things that other adaptations have gone wrong. I think the basic problem with any adaptation on screen and phones is they all get something wrong. And it's a question of what you notice and what personally bothers you. I think we've all got our own personal red lines, things we don't like messed with. They'll vary from one person to another. So there are some things in the Guy Ritchie films that are perfectly correct, but there are so many other things that really just jar. But you can look at any film adaptation, it'll be the same.
Of all the people that portrayed Sherlock Holmes in films and plays, who's been your favourite?
Jeremy Brett, end of. Well, I don't want to disappoint any Benedict fans, but I'm sorry. As far as I'm concerned, you can only be anywhere near definitive if you are Victorian.
Rupert
Everett's not now seemingly the case for the silver stocking. I thought visually very good. If you sort of stand in some of the earlier Paget illustrations before Sherlock Holmes started to go a bit bald, if you see the hair kind of recede a bit more when he started to come back in some of the later illustrations. But I remember an illustration, I think, for the Red-Headed League, where he had a picture of Holmes listening to the violin concert, and he has much longer hair there. And if you stand that picture against the image that Everett portrayed, it's not too far. I'm not a great fan of Alan Hubert's screenplay. And I think it's full of a lot of anachronisms, particularly in connection with the idea of having no sex of intended, intended, but a female psychoanalyst in 1901 was rather unlikely. Nothing wrong with it, but it just didn't look right there, wearing an anachronism. Yes?
So another quick question. How you saw Billy Wilder film a couple of weeks ago?
The Private Life.
What do you think of that film?
I believe it was quite panned at the time, but I quite enjoy it. It's hideously cut about. I think the original cut was something like 3 to 4 hours long, and contained, I think, 2 or 3 stories in one. But they chopped it about so much to get it down to a more conventional feature length. And I think you can see that it sort of leaps about from place to place in an attempt to have this one story rather than the 2 or 3 that were originally in it. I think the casting was excellent. And you've got to be very hard-hearted not to enjoy being Watson Fowler.
I think BTC thinks a lot from Billy Wilder.
Yes.
Well, they're very playful with it. And I think it's great because the fact they both love the original shines through it, even though they're occasionally a bit irreverent with it.
I'm going to bring a microphone now because we've got the questions.
Given we're in St. Bart's this evening, do you have any thoughts on the end of the last episode? maybe not is the answer, but I thought I'd just raise it to Marin Bart's this evening.
It tempts me to a little anecdote before I answer that. Some people, entirely wrongly on Twitter, got it into their heads that I had some knowledge of what was going on.
I didn't realise this until I wrote a tweet when someone asked me from America, I think it was there going to be a Series 3? I said, I don't know. Somehow, a Chinese whispers on Twitter took place, and this became Alistair Duncan says, no third series. I started getting retweeted at a rate you would not believe. And it wasn't until I saw my name popping up, and I thought, I need to stop this before I get a password film letter on my doormat having me running into loads of trouble. I think I managed to novel it. It might explain why when I first met Stephen Moffat, it was a bit frosty. what do I think I'm doing? Cunning attempt to avoid it. The only idea I had is one that's been voiced by many. It seems glaringly obvious, and it almost certainly turned out to be wrong, which is that he fell into a rubbish truck. It seems the most glaringly obvious. You know it's going to be wrong, don't you? It's set up for you to think that. Probably something completely left field, and we'll all be going scratching our heads trying to figure it out. But that's what I'm currently going with based on what I see. I promise you, I've got no inside knowledge whatsoever. Although if I did, I would still say that, wouldn't I? So.
It's a very basic question. Why do you think Sheldon Chuckies, we still love it so much that they still made films, adaptations, and even the comedy scene, you've got Russ Allen doing the Barrett Hughes, people now doing their version of the...
I've not watched that.
And Woods Hammer making a horror film, the
Hand of the Basketball.
Thank you.
Introduced that one 2 weeks ago. Yeah. I'm still trying to get the psychological scars. Roger here in the front row was with me, as was his wife Jean, when we did an interview with NBC.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing, I still can't figure this out, they were trying to crowbar an article about Sherlock Holmes into the Olympics. I'm not quite sure how they managed. I'm looking forward to seeing how they managed to link to it. But they asked me the same question, which I found even more difficult to answer than I do now, because I was standing in a cold street shivering while people looked at me as they walked by. And the answer I gave then, which I think is reasonably good, is I think in America there's a great tradition of superheroes. I think in many respects Sherlock Holmes is one of ours. But I think one of the attractions is there's a certain element of timelessness to him, so you can embrace him at any age. But also for me, I think one of the attractions is that he's theoretically at least an achievable superhero. There's no magical power, there's no radioactive charge. You can believe if you worked at it hard enough that you might get a little of the way in those deductive powers. I think the idea that you could reach out and possibly grab some of that, at least I certainly think it's one of the draws. But I think really, if you ask anybody why they like Holmes, you probably struggle to get more than a tiny answer out of them. It's very difficult. I think it's one of the things you can't really pin down. I mean, if you ask yourself why do you like Holmes, you'll probably find it hard to answer your own question.
It's a good answer.
Well, you've been waiting for ages, haven't you? I've seen that happen.
I was just going to say, what's your favourite story from the canon?
Ooh, Sign of Corp.
That was easy.
I just think it's got everything. I think Conan Doyle got his eye in by then after studying the Scarlet. You've got no lengthy flashbacks. You've got hidden treasure far off land, damsel in distress, and two heroes. You've pretty much got everything you want in a story in one book. But that's my personal reason for it. I mean, I do like many of the short stories, but I think the novels are the best.
I'm going to ask a question about Watson, predictably. Because you were saying the origins of Watson aren't that clear cut. So can you maybe talk a bit about that, and maybe also about Conan Doyle's real-life medical background, and maybe why he picked a doctor as his narrator? Like, is it just self-insertion, or is it more than that?
I'm to borrow other people's theories for this, but I can't better them. One person, I can't remember which biographer it was, said that he chose a medical doctor simply for the reason it was something he could speak about with complete authority. And that was his own background. I think Watson's army service reflected a frustrated soldier in Conan Doyle who desperately wanted to see him and repeatedly tried doing so during his life, the closest of God to being a field medic in the World War. Sorry, what was the rest of that question?
Yeah, just talk about the origins of Watson, so besides the real life.
Well, we've talked at length about that, and I say it's a clear cut because it's, you know, there's lots of theories, most of which I can't remember off the top of my head. I mean, there's the one of the documentary I alluded to, but it was another one of his professors, Patrick Heron, and it's fired in. I think there's a book. It's a book called The Study in South Sea that I think mentions the name of a Dr. John Watson.
James
Watson, I think. Maybe that'll explain why it becomes James later. Can't get it all right. I'm up here, you haven't got the pressure. Yeah, so there's another doctor in Portsmouth who might have inspired him. And there is, in my most recent book, and this has nothing to do with the origins of Watson, but it was an amusing coincidence that some of you, if you know anything about Conan Doyle, will know he got involved in the case of Georgia Dowdy, who was wrongly convicted of maiming horses in Staffordshire. And I did a lot of research into the press at the time there, and the police in that case hired a veterinary surgeon to look into some of the wounds of some of the animals, and his name was John Watson, which was a rather amusing coincidence, but obviously has no bearing on the origin of Watson himself. I really can't add too much more.
I'll just add that originally Dr. Watson wasn't Dr. Watson.
No,
he was Ormond Sacker.
So you finished
it. No wonder they changed it.
Ormond Sacker and Sherringford, I believe, was the original
names.
I don't know why they were changed, but I think probably all agree
it
was good they were changed.
I know we talked about film adaptations, and you were saying on the side of the floor. I don't know if you had a chance to read the graphic novel adaptation on the side of the
floor. I've read one, and maybe more than one.
That's the reason why some play Hero and Kuba.
Is that the one that they've done on the four novels?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I have read that one. I rather liked it, but in many respects I actually preferred their version of The Study in Scarlet. They managed to take that whole Norman bit and actually make it less of a trial to wade through. No disrespect to Norman's intended, but that's kind of distract from the main kind of plot. You can kind of lose that whole section if you're reading the book and not really miss too much. But going back to the original question, I do like that.
Yeah. Do you think also that it didn't shy away from Holmes's addictions, which is something that tends to get a bit callow and is amusing the uses a nicotine patch in the new series?
I complained about that on some message boards and got shot down in flames for my unrealistic expectations when it had Sherlock Holmes shooting up in a modern series. But if you look, if you've seen Richard Roxburgh's Hand of the Baskervilles from about 2000, they depicted it very badly there. Because, I mean, one of the things that you know is that Sherlock Holmes only ever took the drug to a ball, never in the middle of a case. So having Richard Roxburgh shooting up in the middle of a railway station toilet here, the Baskervilles is very jarring. I didn't like it. But I think that I admire adaptations when they choose to bring that in, because it's quite a brave thing to do. Because it was very commonplace back then. I mean, I think the QI series has talked more than once about the great binge, the period when you could buy drugs
at your toothpaste.
Yeah, I mean, you could buy drugs at Fortnum's or Harrods in Hanker, anything you wanted, heroin through. Heroin Procrastinators, I think. So it was much easier for Conan Doyle to write about it then. Because I think whilst the dangers were understood, it was a relatively commonplace thing. I think it's much harder to do it. So I retract my statement from the internet about they should have the needle out in the series. I appreciate the difficulties of it.
Yeah, in that regard, like, you didn't like the patches, but how about in Scandal in Belgravia when they mentioned like the Danger Knight? So they sort of alluded that he was maybe dabbling in something harder than just cigarettes.
They try and steer that into hidden cigarette patches, don't
they? I don't think it was cigarettes.
I hope you haven't messed up my sock drawer, I believe.
My sock index.
Sock index, yeah. It's not word perfect at all. I think it's good that they allude to it in their own little way. I like the little nods. But like, as I said, I appreciate they can't have any sort of fondly looking at the drawer with a needle in it.
Do you
answer
what I
asked
you out? Do you remember the first times that you've ever heard about Sherlock Holmes and how you got into it?
Vividly. I was 8. Recovering from, and I've discussed it with my parents at some length, and we can't agree on the question, but it was something that lasted for about a week. I think it was chickenpox. My mother thinks it was scarlatina, whatever that is. I think my father was convinced it was flu. But whatever it was, it's one of those illnesses that keeps you a prisoner of your bedroom for about a week. And you must have had this, all of you, when you were a child. You basically confined to your room. You saw two rooms, your room and the bathroom, for a week. And eventually you got to the state where you were crying out to see any other room. And I remember that I dragged myself downstairs. It must have been roughly 5 o'clock on a Saturday. In time for my mother to flick over the television in the days where there was, I believe, only BBC 1, 2 and ITV, showing my age, and BBC 2, Basil Rathbone and The Scarlet Claw. I was terrified for ages by a man in a fluorescent suit running around in the marshes of Canada. But it got me started. I watched every episode that came on every Saturday after that until they ran out. At some point, my child curiosity caused me to go to my mother and ask her about it. She pointed out they were based on books. She did not point out they were based on books in Victorian time. So when she gave me a copy of the first set of 12 short stories to read, and I opened it, I was immediately thrown into all kinds of confusion. Where are the Nazis? Where are the guns? Where are the telephones? Why is Watson remotely intelligent? Why are there horses and carriages? What is going on? I think I read about 3 pages of Scandal in Bohemia. I nearly said not great. Before I shut the book and didn't attempt to read Sherlock Holmes again for 2 years. And the reason I know it's 2 years is because a man unlocked it for me, and hence why I admire him so greatly, was Jeremy Brett. Because when the Bernard series began in 1984, the episode it opened with was a Scandal in Bohemia. So I watched that. My childlike imagination was then saw a kind of a hard drive wipe of Basil Rathbone and replaced Jeremy Brett. I was able to open the book again, and instead of seeing Basil Rathbone looking in vain for Nazis, I was able to see Jeremy Brett and David Burton. And I had a whole visual frame of reference, and I devoured the whole canon from there on in. So Jeremy Brett is up there. For me, it was A, they're very good adaptations, you can't deny that until you get to the end of them, of course. But at the beginning, sort of the first 2 or 3 series, you can't really follow. But also because he basically unlocked that entire world for me. That's the left bone drew me in. Jeremy Brett kept me, if you like. So I wouldn't praise him over and above everyone else, even the Saint Benedict. I do like Benedict. Jeremy Brett will.
Well, I hope everybody enjoyed that, I certainly did. And I think as well as giving a hand to Sherlock Holmes, the superhero, then we should also give a hand to Alistair for a really interesting talk.